and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, NPR Istanbul correspondent Peter Kenyon. He was recorded at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium in Anchorage on October 24th, 2010, as part of the APRN Speaker Series.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Lindbeck. I'm the President and General Manager for Alaska Public Telecommunications. We operate KSKA 91.1, KAKM Channel 7, and the Alaska Public Radio Network. And I am just thrilled. Thank you. And I'll just take this moment to mention that KSKA is the number one most listened to station in Anchorage, so thank you all. Anyway, I am just delighted to be here today and to welcome you to what is the first in what we hope will be a very rich annual tradition in our community. We are undertaking this Alaska Public Radio News and Public Affairs speaker series as a self-conscious fundraising effort to support the cause that is the reason we're here, to provide that news and public affairs coverage that we know you value. We don't do this because we love it. We do this because we know you love it, and you show us that virtually every day. And that's why KSK is the number one station in Anchorage. But we're also very proud to say that given the difficult circumstances in media these days, the Alaska Public Radio Network is still the last Alaska news organization that has a full-time correspondent in Washington, D.C., and we're the last Alaska news organization that has a full-time correspondent in Juneau, apart from the local stations in Juneau. So this is good and very important work, and it's something we're very proud to be able to provide for our community and for our state. And this speaker series, and what we hope will be many, many, many more to follow, is very frankly in support of that good work. So thank you for being here to help us kick it off and to show the way for what we hope will be a very rich tradition in the future. So without any more explanation, I'd like to introduce our speaker today. We're very pleased to have as the very first speaker in this event, Peter Kenyon, who we think of as one of our own, welcoming him home. Peter began his career in journalism in Petersburg in 1983-2. As a radio reporter for KFSK Radio in Petersburg. In 1985, he went to work in Juneau as the Juneau correspondent for the Alaska Public Radio Network. And then in 1991, he came to Anchorage to work at APRN here in the headquarters. In 95, he went to work at NPR in Washington, D.C., and spent about 6 years covering Washington, primarily the United States Senate. And then he went abroad, where he has become one of the United States' most distinguished foreign correspondents and one of the best known, because he has been reporting from the real hot spots, mostly in the Middle East. He was stationed first in Jerusalem, starting in 2001, and then in Cairo in 2005. As you can imagine, he traveled frequently to the hot spots across the Middle East, and he will have much more to tell us, I hope, about some adventures in the Middle East. This spring, he was moved again, and he's now stationed in Istanbul. So when I sent Peter an email about 4 months ago, I think asking if he would come to this, it was an email going to Istanbul, and he sent back immediately, yes, he'd be pleased to come and inaugurate this event. So let me introduce one of our own who's gone out and done a fabulous job for all of us, Peter Kenyon.
Well, thank you all for coming out, and I'll try to live up to that introduction, but it is really great to be back in Alaska, and I'm really glad to see you guys come out for APRN and the public radio news mission here, because I had a great time working for APRN. I learned a lot, and I just think it's a real treasure here, and anything we can do to keep it going, I'm all for it. As Steve said, I started in Petersburg. I remember walking up the steps to the above the old gym at the old high school where KFSK was located. And I walked in, and the program director marched up to me and said, "Do you know classical music?" And I said, Bach, good, show up at 9 o'clock here. And that's how I became the classical music host at KFSK Petersburg. That's how I learned about classical music, too. It was a good coincidence. And then my next clear memory is talking on the phone in a little cabin to Corey Flintoff, the voice of Alaska News Nightly, the man with the smiling voice. And I said, hey, is that Juno job still open? Molly McCammon had just been having it, and before her, Patty Ginsburg. And this is like a few weeks before the session starts, I think. And he goes, yeah, sure, you want it? And that was another great learning experience. I walked into that newsroom. It used to be on the second floor of the Capitol. All the different news organizations were there, whispering into their phones so no one could hear what they were saying. And 2 months after I got there, I walked back one day, and the newsroom was empty. Nobody was in there. And that's always a very bad sign. So it was the North Slope borough scandal being broken. I had a series of interesting stories to come after that. Not long after that, we were trying to impeach our governor, as I recall, and that's how I first got on an NPR story. So it was a great place to learn about political reporting, and as I was telling some people before, the biggest surprise when I finally went to Washington many years later was how similar it all was in Congress. It was the same small group of people who really knew what was going on, but there was just hundreds of people in between you and them running interference now that made it so much harder to figure it out yourself. So, anyway, if it's okay, I will try to put my theory to the test that there are Americans, in our audience especially, who do like to hear about what's going on in the rest of the world. So I will... So I'll just talk a little bit about some of the places I've been and some of the experiences I've had, because it really has been an eye-opener for me going to learn thousands of years of history or trying and these new cultures and new ways of looking at the world and certainly different ways of looking at the United States. It's great to challenge your own myths and see what other people think. I just most recently was in Iraq for the latest time. I've been going there since 2003, a couple months at a time. And now, of course, as you all saw in the paper with this WikiLeaks dump of some 400,000 pages of classified material, the entire country's getting to relive those bad old days of horrible bloodshed and sectarian violence that followed the toppling of Saddam Hussein. And however you feel about, you know, whether those documents should have been released, it really is good, I think, to recall how deep the misery was for Iraq in 05, 06, and 07, as we watched them try to struggle pretty ineffectively to have a peaceful transfer of power now and get a new government going. They have been, in fact, smashing all records for political inactivity, or certainly activity that doesn't add up to much. Decades of Saddam Hussein has given way to a new prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, who was in term for one office and decided, yeah, I guess I'm the only one who really can run the country. And so he's now decided that he'd like to stay no matter what, and that's his only condition for continuing those talks. The Americans have been in an increasingly difficult position in Iraq. They've been pushing for months with remarkable vagueness, I must say. We have no preferred candidate. We just want a good policy, a good process. And then Iran convinced Muqtada al-Sadr, the hardline anti-American Shiite cleric, to throw his weight behind Maliki, giving him a lot of momentum towards retaining power if he plays ball with the Sadrists. And all of a sudden, the Americans said, well, maybe we ought to stop and think about this a little bit, and we may not want to rush into things too often. The problem for the Americans is they want a big coalition. They want everybody involved, the Kurds, the Sunnis, the Shiites. And yet they really don't want the Sadrists involved because they're very close to Iran, as are a lot of the religious parties. And they are very much opposed to this vision that the Americans have of a long-term partnership with Iraq that a lot of people hope will lead to big arms sales and all kinds of other lucrative deals. I think, though, they're underestimating the influence of Iran. Its vision of Iraq is much more anti-war, put it that way. They fought a 10-year war, And really all I care about now is having an Iraq that is weak, always off balance, and consequently no threat to Iran. So I think it's going to be really difficult to see a kind of big inclusive government that the Americans would like to see. They may try it. It's going to be hard to see how it would all work. There simply isn't enough power to be shared out. And also, you kind of have to keep an eye on, I keep coming back to Muqtada al-Sadr, who is living in Iran, by the way. He's not even there. He has not given up on his vision, which is kind of to be a Hezbollah in Iraq, which is to say an Iranian-backed force that is at once, on the one hand, a big political player and also a very powerful militia force. And that is something that makes a lot of people in the West very nervous, and probably with good reason. But I think that is going to be a real stumbling block here as we go forward. And if that isn't complicated enough, one analyst has already pointed out that any coalition of the size that the U.S. is proposing is going to require amending the Constitution in Iraq, which is about as easy as getting the electricity to stay on for 24 hours. So, I mean, I don't know how they're going to do that. But I think I would go next to my new assignment, which is to pay a lot more attention to Iran. And that is not so easy because they don't let American reporters in these days. And my family thinks that's the good news. So, but actually, I've always wanted to go. I remember showing up in Jerusalem in 2001, and my predecessor, Jennifer Ludden, said, "You've got to go to Iran. The people are amazing. They really want to change. They hate the mullahs. It's a wonderful story. You've got to go." And then, of course, the Intifada broke out, and I couldn't go anywhere for 4 years. So I never did get there, and now it's incredibly hard. But I do think she's right. I mean, I think the people are amazing. It's just working there as a journalist is so incredibly difficult right now. Mr. Khamenei, the Grand Ayatollah, has gone on a trip to Qum, which is the holy city where all the Shiite clerics learn. And he's kind of on a political shoring up effort because he's been under fire, especially since the elections that returned Ahmadinejad to power, which are widely reviled as fraudulent. And the major crackdown that he's used against the Green Movement, the pro-reform movement, since then, has revealed the totalitarian side of Iran, which is not what they like to talk about. They like to see themselves as a powerhouse in the Middle East and a model for other countries to emulate. But I think the Green Movement, which has startled everyone with this huge eruption in 2009, has pretty much been beaten back into submission for now. But they haven't gone away. I talk to refugees as they come across into Turkey now. And they're thinking in terms of 5 years, 10 years, but they are planning for the next uprising or the next chance to vote, perhaps, if that comes around. But I think at the moment, Ahmadinejad is more than happy to use whatever force is necessary to stay in power. At the same time, the economy is really in the tanks. There are gas rationing problems. The people are quite unhappy with his leadership. They just don't have a way to express themselves yet. But I think they might. I think it might happen. It won't happen soon, but I think it's going to be a very interesting story in the next several years. Over in Egypt, they are having elections again, which reminds me of when I moved there in 2005. Hosni Mubarak had the first multi-candidate elections ever there in Egypt. And they're going to be voting again later this year for parliament and then next year for the president. It's not clear if Mubarak's going to run again. The Egyptians, they're a hardy lot. They don't have much. Most of them are very poor, but they like a good laugh and they love to tell jokes. And one of the only ones I really remember is about Mubarak. It's an aide comes running into his office, waving pieces of paper, saying, Mr. President, I've got it. Finally, it's finished. Your farewell address to the people. And Mubarak says, "Why, are they going somewhere?" So, anyway, that's Egyptian humor for you, but they're a resilient lot. the desperation there is really quite something, though. I mean, thousands and thousands of graduates come out of these colleges every year, and they've got no hope for jobs. Their families are paying bribes to get them into the police, which is one of the few jobs with benefits. Although not necessarily the same kind of benefits your union leaders here might talk about. I remember my family came to visit when we were, we took them down to Luxor to visit the Valley of the Kings and went around looking for a place for lunch, and we found a very nice hotel. And the people showed us around and they said, no, we're not open yet, but here you can look around the place. And my father said, oh, nice place. Who owns this? And they said, oh, the police own this. So it is a little different there. But Cairo itself is a really amazing place. I mean, I'm sure some of you may have already been, and if you think about it, it really is a wonderful place to visit. Crazy, smog-filled, overcrowded, you know, 20 million people, but there's just something about it. It's such, on paper, it's such an unsustainable project, and yet somehow they keep going. My neighbor, Max Rodenbeck, who writes for The Economist, he wrote a terrific book about Cairo, and in it he wrote, Cairo is a city that has been on the verge of collapse for 7,000 years. So that pretty much sums it up. I have moved now to Istanbul, and that is a real eye-opener. It's an amazing city. It's so beautiful. The people are remarkable. The food is great. The views are wonderful. And it's got, I think, the worst bureaucracy in the world. I've never seen anything like it. I thought Cairo was bad. You know, in Cairo, they have downtown, they have this building called the Mugama, this big Gothic-looking structure where people go in and are never heard from again, you know. But Turkey somehow has managed to beat them at that game. I guess they kind of invented bureaucracy, or they certainly perfected it. I remember waiting for my stuff to show up and sat at the port while I had to go find a typewriter and type in Turkish on special yellow pages everything that I owned. And that had to get sent to Ankara, 5 copies each, stamped and sent back to Istanbul. And that was just the tip of the iceberg. They're really amazing in the way they do it. But they are in the news these days because, well, they're just a booming economy, for one thing, and they're playing with everybody, including some people that the Americans don't want them to play with. They are probably, I would put them on a tier just below China, India, maybe Brazil. I mean, they're maybe just below that, but they really are a booming economy. They're a major powerhouse in the Middle East, and they're probably going to be more so in the coming years. They are dying to get their hands on the Iranian gas from the South Pars gas field and figure out a way to be the middleman to sell it to Europe, even though you're not supposed to do that under sanctions. They have huge trade all the way from China to Saudis to Iraq. I was just in Iraq, and pretty much all the products are Turkish. And they really are taking advantage of their position. And the politics there are just completely fascinating and really different from what I've been used to. I've covered secular versus Islamist issues all over the Middle East. And then you come to Turkey and everything's kind of turned around. I mean, it's the pro-Western people who want to be secular and who believe in a top-down regimented society, because all that was handed down by Kemal Atatürk from the 1920s, and it was forced on them, and they've embraced that whole method, and it's the AK party, the Islamist party, that's trying to loosen things up and have civil rights. And the problem for the secular people is that one of those rights is like to wear the headscarf, and so that becomes a big issue. But, you know, all your labels get, you know, twisted and turned around in Turkey. It's just a really fascinating place, and they're having a huge debate. The institutions that are the mainstays of the secularist Kemalist vision, the university, the army, and judiciary, have all been chipped away at, and they've all been sort of, inroads have been made by the AK party in every one of those areas. And the opposition, the secular opposition, is fighting amongst itself, and they've got elections next year, and I think the AK party's going to win again. And it's a real test for political Islam. Can there be a moderate Islamic party that the West will accept? Because at the moment, the Europeans are just saying, no, no, no. They're not ready to accept them. And it really is the most pro-reform-minded party in Turkey's modern history. I mean, the things that they have done to change their laws, to bring them more in line with European standards, really remarkable. And yet, there's still these mysterious Turkish problems. I mean, you can still get arrested in Turkey for insulting Turkishness, and people have been. And if you're an independent newspaper and you get a little too independent, all of a sudden you have a massive tax fraud case on your back or something. So it's, you know, they've got a long way to go in some of that stuff. The cornerstone of their foreign policy is zero problems with the neighbors. And yet the Turkish army regularly has to bomb in northern Iraq because the Kurdish rebels are coming across and trying to do operations. Their border with Armenia has been closed for some 15 years, and not just because of the genocide issue. It's very complicated, but they've certainly got their share of problems there. So obviously there is no such thing as zero problems with the neighbors, but they're working on it. They've improved their relations with Iran, much to the consternation of Washington. 1.3 million Iranians come across the border every year into Turkey without a visa. And they've been doing that for about 10 years now. And just this last year, they adopted the same policy with Syria, which sets up a kind of an interesting traffic triangle, it seems to me. But anyway, I just think, I'm still learning about Turkey. I just got there, and I'm really looking forward to doing some more stories on that, and hopefully I'll get an Iran visa one of these days. I want to, let you ask some questions if you'd like. I don't want to just babble on here the whole time. I thought maybe I'd say a few words about media and things like that before we do. I'm pretty much astonished. If anybody had told me that, when I first, walked into that upstairs at the gym in KFSK, that, when by 2010, NPR would be the biggest foreign desk in all of broadcasting media in America, I would have been, forget it, that's not possible. And in fact, we're even bigger than most newspapers. It's only the top tier newspapers that have more foreign correspondents than we do now. And it really is a perplexing time in the media. I think, what's really amazing is you even hear these proposals from analysts saying that, well, this public broadcasting model, maybe that's what a lot of media should adopt. It seems to be working in these terrible times of crisis. And I don't know. I don't think the non-commercial, non-profit, going out and begging every year model is going to work for all of these big news organizations. But the idea that it keeps coming up, I think it does reflect something that is real, and that's something that people in the public broadcasting world have known for a long time, and that is that people will chip in to get, quality journalism done, and they like to have it, and they expect it, and I think that's because there is, and there ought to be, an element of public service in really good journalism. And, the fact that public radio doesn't really get all that much money from the federal government directly anymore is not really the point. I think simply because we do go out there, stations go out there really, I should say, and ask for money every year, ask them to pitch in, make a statement that this is a worthwhile service to have. That, to me, is the main reason why it's probably a good thing that, we don't make huge TV salaries, we don't, spend massive amounts of money building up, personalities into celebrities the way you see with television. It probably doesn't hurt that I flew here stuffed in a giant carry-on bag and I'm living in a dumpster over on Fourth Avenue, I'm staying in a very nice house and they're great cooks, so that's fine. But I really want to thank everyone for coming out here, because I think that it shows that you do care, as I said before, that there are Americans that care what's going on out in the rest of the world. We're not just navel-gazing isolationists, as some of our smugger European friends like to think. And I think, actually, I will bring this back to Alaska eventually, believe me, I do think that translates to Alaska News as well. I mean, more so here than in a lot of other states. People listen to APRN because they know there's more to Alaska than just the rail belt plus a little Juneau bashing every once in a while. And I think the commitment that APRN stations make and that APRN makes to keep a line open to the bush, they keep finding people to go or to live there or to go to these villages and learn journalism, share the stories, to see that commitment and to see people support that, I think is a great thing. And as someone who had a small hand in APRN at various levels over about 10-year period, I mean, it seems to me that this commitment and the partnership between the stations and APRN that makes it possible, so you can have shows like Alaska News Nightly and AK Now, Talk of the Alaska, I think makes the winters a little bit warmer here. And I'm glad they're here. And I'm very glad you all came out. And thanks very much. If you have any questions, I think there's a microphone over there.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Peter Kenyon, NPR foreign correspondent in Istanbul, Turkey. He gave a talk and then responded to audience member questions at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium in Anchorage on October 24th, 2010.
Peter, I was wondering if there was one story in particular, one report that stood out as just shook you to your core. More so than anything else, where you were not necessarily a reporter, but just a person?
Well, I think just probably because it was my first assignment, being in the West Bank and in Israel during that time of that intifada was, just your eyes were opened so many times. You just... Every day you see something that people there are used to, and it's been going on for years, but it's just so foreign to anything that, you know, you could imagine. And as far as stories that shake you, I don't know. The story that I remember the most is actually kind of a little featurey thing. It wasn't a big war story. There was this girls' soccer team in this little Arab-Israeli village up in the north, part of Israel, but it was Arab population. And they wanted to have a soccer team, and their elders, the old conservative older guy, said, no, you can't go running around in shorts, we can't have that. But it was that town is called Sakhnin, is a big soccer town. Their boys' team was, really world class, and so the girls wanted to do it. And finally they got to do it, and they turned out to be great. They beat everybody. They beat all the Israeli teams. They won their division. I think they're like junior high school sort of age. And that was nice, that's a nice little story. But then what happened after that was the part that was really interesting to me, because if you win your division, you get to go to the Maccabiya, which is the Jewish Olympics. So they all go down to, they have a big fight in town because nobody in the Arab town wants to support the Jewish Olympics, but the girls insist on going, so. You've got the, Tel Aviv people walking in with their flag, the Jerusalem people, and here come these little Arab girls with their playing. It was a terrific story. I just loved it. They lost in the finals to the Americans, but anyway, was a memorable story for me.
Hi. Could you give us a little information about the status of women in the Middle East?
Well, it's pretty varied. A friend of mine, Megan Stack, who wrote for the Los Angeles Times for many years, still does. She's in Moscow now, but when she was in the Middle East at the same time I was, she would go to Saudi Arabia quite frequently. And when she left, after 5 years of doing those trips, she wrote a terrific sort of kiss-off story to the Saudis about all of the harassment and all of the trouble she'd had just being there as a foreign woman, let alone, as what happens to Saudi women. But things like... being kicked out of Starbucks because she hadn't gone in the women's entrance, and she'd be standing outside of a bank, and her translator would be inside getting money, and the vice police would come up to her and start harassing her because she was a woman standing on a street all by herself, which is obviously can't have that. It's a bit complicated for a foreigner to come in and see how difficult things are for women, because they don't really appreciate being told that by outsiders and foreigners, and I think the Bush administration found that when they would send Karen Hughes around to the various countries to help them, and she would wind up getting yelled at by all of these very articulate Arab women who were saying, who are you to tell us how to live? So it's a touchy subject, but my own opinion, it's a very difficult place to live as a woman in some areas. Some places are much better than others. Lebanon is much better. Jordan's quite a bit better. Saudi's quite a bit worse. Iran can be quite a bit worse. And yet, in Iran in particular, there is this tradition of your home is your castle. And so inside your own home, there is a whole range of life that goes on. It's just what we see in public is so different.
Thanks so much for coming. Would you share some of your observations of the perceptions of the U.S. and Americans in the various countries that you travel in?
My first taste of that was right after 9/11. I was in Cairo getting public reaction. And after the usual, yes, isn't it terrible? I'm sorry. It was almost always a dose of, well, you had it coming. You knew what was going on. And then there was always, oh, and by the way, 400 Jews didn't go to work that day in the Twin Towers. Did you know that? These bizarre conspiracy theories. And the perception of Americans, I have to say, did not do so well during the 8 years of the Bush administration. That was, it was a pretty rough ride. Although my polite Cairo friends would always be quick to say, look, we know you're not the government. You know, we make a distinction between American people and the American government. But basically, it was not easy, you know, being an American in those days. And the relief when Barack Obama was elected, I mean, that really went all the way around the world. And it's still, he's still living off that overseas. I mean, he's, of course, in big fights here at home now. But overseas, they're still so happy that he's not George Bush.
Welcome back to Alaska, Peter. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you.
I would like you to comment a little bit, if you can, on some of the energy issues in Central Asia and Afghanistan, Turkey, and the Middle East, and how they relate to some of the political turmoil that's going on.
Well, they relate to a lot of things. I mean, I can barely touch on the highlights of that one. But that, for instance, I was talking about the problem in Armenia, and there is, of course, the age-old problem of whether the Turks are ever going to call the World War I slaughter of Armenians a genocide or not. However, what Turks and Armenians will tell you there on the ground, the real reason that it's closed is because of the fight between Azerbaijan and Armenia over this region called Nagorno-Karabakh that Armenia is occupying with Russian military help. And one of the reasons they're doing that is because there's gas pipelines that run through all of there, and a lot of money is going into certain pockets, and those people want to make sure it stays that way. So this is another conflict that may never get resolved just for that reason. I'm interested in pipelines a lot these days. They really, they've got one now from Iraq going into Jihan on the Black Sea. There's one coming down. The Russians have now sort of elbowed aside a Turkish prospect for a pipeline, and so now there's a new Russian gas line that some people are thinking might, you know, get a lot more gas into Europe that way. But there's huge political fights going on over energy, and the sanctions against Iran are just really, you know, the tip of the iceberg. But there's a huge amount of energy that's in those areas, and it's going to come out. And if the West isn't going to deal with them, then China certainly will. I mean, China, which has a voracious need for energy, loves to go to places where everybody else won't go. They love Nigeria. They love a lot of these African dysfunctional states. And they love other hotspots and Iran, too. They have great ties with Iran. So I think energy issues are a big, big part of what's going on. And there's still a lot of Iraqis who will tell you they think the war was all about their oil and that they're just waiting for the American oil companies to move in and try and get their contracts signed. And they are trying.
I'd like to also welcome you back to Alaska, and can almost guarantee that we won't handcuff you. I'd like to have you speak to the path that Turkey can get to the EU and what path you think that will take?
They've got a tough road at the moment. They were doing quite well. And as I said before, they've made a lot of reforms that have boosted their chances. And yet, I'm pretty convinced, and Turks are pretty convinced now, that the Europeans just don't want them. They look at Turkey and they see a very large Muslim country with very open borders to the rest of the Middle East. And what they see is a gateway. You know, they're spending a lot of money and time beating back immigrants coming across from Morocco into Italy and coming out of Libya and coming across from Egypt. And then they just think, well, all I have to do is get into Turkey and then they'll be part of the EU. And then it's just a domestic flight to London or to France. And it's really France and Germany that are the main opposition at the moment. The Americans would like to see them in the EU. Unfortunately, I just don't see it happening anytime soon.
The normally good relations between Israel and Turkey were enormously strained as a result of the raid on the Mavi Marmara. It's my understanding that there's another Turkish ship with the same humanitarian aid group is going to join an international flotilla to Gaza in February, and they're inviting journalists to jump on board. Do you plan to do something like that?
Well, I don't know. I might. I watched the Mavi Marmara attack, and I mean, from a distance, I wasn't on it, but and it really was a strange episode. And you'd get into ages of legal terminology about whether it was justified and what this law of the sea is and why they did it and what the blockade means. I did notice that some Viva Palestina convoy just got in last week again, and they got in without anybody getting hurt, and they delivered their aid. I mean, frankly, the stuff they're delivering is not all that critical. It's almost completely a symbolic effort to try and break the blockade, and except for concrete. They really, really need concrete, because all of that rubble from the war that the Israelis bombed all of these buildings, very few of them have been rebuilt. And they are not allowing concrete in on the grounds that it could be used for military purposes to make bunkers or other some such. And steel could be used, pipes could be used to make rockets. Dual use technology has been stretched to, you know, absurd extremes here. Not that they're not trying to make rockets and send bombs, because they are. But it's an unsustainable situation. At some point, there's got to be a way that people can at least rebuild their homes and their offices. And if they don't figure out a way to do that and keep Israel secure, then it's just going to continue to deteriorate. Because the bigger picture is, as long as you've got Gaza and the West Bank split and divided with two different leaderships on the Palestinian side, you're never going to be able to get a peace agreement, even if you could get something through the Israeli government, which is in no mood to agree to anything right now anyway. So I think these aid convoys are symbolic but important in terms of getting people to pay attention. I think that the sad thing, and the thing that has been reinforced now so many times over the decades, is that what got people to pay attention to Gaza again was people getting killed, which is what gives these aid groups, you know, or these activist groups, you know, their incentive to do these things.
I wonder if you could give us some thumbnail sketches or insights into a couple of the more interesting leadership personalities in the Middle East. I think of people like Iyad Alawi or Bashir Assad. Is he really a reformer or not a reformer? And I don't know if you've been to Syria, but Erdogan in Turkey, people like that, just those people or any others that you think it would be interesting interesting to
Bashir's
talk about.
Bashir's a very interesting guy. Bashir Assad, the son of Hafez al-Assad in Syria. We did interview him. NPR every year does a foreign desk meeting, those of us who go to Iraq. And one year we did it in Damascus. And it was at a time when the U.S. was isolating them pretty severely. So they were so happy to see Americans come in. They just said, oh, come on in. You want to interview the president? You know, here, he's right here. And so we all trooped in and asked him a lot of questions. He's an interesting guy. He's very tall and I don't know, sort of wavy arm movements and big Adam's apple. He's a soft-spoken guy. A lot of people, you know, which is so different from his dad, you know, who was known as old Iron Pants, the guy who could sit down there and negotiate with you for, you know, 20 hours and never get up and never say yes to anything. But Bashir was supposed to be a reformer, but he's just surrounded by the old guard, and the old guard has their grip in, on him, and he just has his hands tied. And at this point, he's been there for long enough that it's not, I'm not clear that he still remembers what a reformer would have to act like. So I'm not sure what's going to happen there. There's a big push, as you can imagine, among the Americans to pull Syria out of Iran's orbit, because they're not natural bedfellows. They have nothing in common. I mean, Syria is was much more comfortable being with Egypt, you know, in the United Arab Republic all those many years ago. But I think those ties are there for a while. Ayad Alawi is an interesting guy as well. Tough guy, very tough guy. But he finds himself as a secular Shiite in front of a group that is almost entirely made up of Sunnis. And he just... He won the election, but he can't win. I mean, it's one of those crazy Iraqi things. And I'm afraid that I think Maliki will get another term simply because nobody else can get the votes.
The Middle East has probably the largest concentration of fossil fuel reserves in the world. Does the topic of climate change ever come up? And how do they view that as a threat to their ongoing prosperity?
It varies. It varies. They in Egypt, I know, they talked about it quite a bit because in Alexandria they're worried about going underwater up there when the sea starts to rise. And in Abu Dhabi, they are building a so-called energy efficient or, you know, zero energy usage city. That can't be right, but you know what I mean. Very efficient city there for new technologies, and they're spending lots of money on alternative energy technologies. The Saudis, not so much. The Saudis pretty much just want to squeeze everything they can out of their oil, and they have done some diversification in terms of, you know, education and medical advances, but they're pretty much still a fossil fuel bastion. I think that they've got a lot to worry about in climate change because it is so hot there already, and the amount of the air conditioning bills in Dubai are insane. I mean, it's, you know, like people huddle around the wood stove here. Everybody huddles around their air conditioner in Dubai, and it's just unbelievable the amounts of money that are being spent to super cool these buildings that are half empty and, you know, we're only built for money laundering purposes anyway. So, anyway, I'm not sure that completely answered your question, but.
Peter, my question is more around the news gathering process, and there are a couple of angles to this. How often do you do a story? I'm sorry, I don't keep track. I haven't counted. How often do you do a piece, and how much of your time is spent basically gathering information about just understanding where you are, and how much on specific stories? If you could sort of talk about how it works to be a foreign correspondent. Mm-hmm.
Well, in my case, it worked. It worked this way. I worked all the time in Israel because it was a war, and there is this huge American appetite for news from that particular place. And so I was filing almost every day for a long time. It felt like they do keep track somewhere in NPR about how many stories you do. And there was, you know, people were doing this many stories. And then there was me. You know, I just sort of never stopped. But then when I got to Cairo, it was 180 degrees different. I mean, things take a long time to get done in Cairo. Just getting across town takes a long time. But learning the different, and I have to say, I also had, you know, 15, 16 countries to cover at that point. So you just have to spend so much time learning the different histories, trying to get a little survival basic language skills. You know, the Arabic tends to be different in all the different countries. I mean, like going to Yemen is just one of the most exotic things you'll ever do. What a beautiful, messed up country. I mean, gorgeous, you know, gingerbread houses, you know, jutting out of these sheer cliff faces, and the guys walking around in skirts with daggers stuffed phallically right here, and they're waste, and very polite, lovely, wonderful people, but also incredibly conservative and very, very poor, and about to run out of water. You know, any month or any year now, I mean, Sana'a's going to run dry because they've just been, they're down to what they call their Jurassic water. They've been drilling for so long, and they have no way to replace it. And so that place is going to be, and now, of course, the West is very concerned about terrorism there, but I mean, it could be a real disaster there in Yemen. But anyway, so anyway, it takes a lot longer in some countries to get these stories done, plus getting people to show up at your interviews. There's a very oriental way of saying, yes, of course, come over, or maybe we could do it tomorrow. Maybe the day, how long are you staying? You know, when are you leaving? You know, so interviews, they never quite say no, but interviews a lot of times just don't happen. So yeah, it does, so the pace has dropped off a bit.
Welcome back to the Northland. I guess my question's along the same lines. When you're setting up in Turkey, what all is involved as far, do you have to find interpreters and drivers and how big a staff? And mm-hmm. so that as I'm thinking of you reporting in, the background that went into you getting in a position where you could make a report on something and the contacts you make and that sort of thing. Thanks. Well,
that's a good question. I'm sure, Patty, you were probably getting at some of that as well, and I didn't mention it, but you really do live by your translators in a lot of ways, and it's a remarkably delicate and difficult task translating, you know, your country to a foreigner. It's not just the language, it's you know, connotations and background and baggage that comes with whatever this person is saying that you have to somehow communicate very quickly. And there, some people are really good at it, and some people really aren't, and there are a few that actually, you know, have an agenda and will change the translation, maybe just because they're embarrassed for their countrymen. They don't want them to sound stupid on the air. But, you know, you can't have that. You've got to be very alert to, I'll give you one very easy example. In the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, if you ask, you know, what do you think about what the Israelis are doing, at some point in the Arabic that comes back at you, they will say, Yahud, Karahara, the Jews did this, the Jews did that, and yet the translator would turn to you and say, the Israelis did this, the Israelis did that, which is not quite what they meant. I mean, some Palestinians do refer to them as, use it interchangeably, but more often they don't. They really mean the Jews, and it's better if you would say it that way. So, yeah, it's in here in Turkey anyway, I need a Turkish translator because it is one tough language. And nobody speaks English, really. I was kind of shocked about that, actually. And I also need a Farsi translator because I'd be focusing on Iran a lot. And I found a young man who's helping me with the refugees who come across, and hopefully will be helping me when I eventually maybe ever get in there. Yeah, so it is a group effort, and it really makes a difference. And foreign correspondents are pretty good about sharing that information, usually, you know, with a few exceptions. They're very good at helping a new reporter get their feet on the ground and find the reliable people. So it helps a lot.
Thank you. Thanks very much for coming. You mentioned the colleague in Cairo who had written a book about that situation. If you could reiterate that author's name, and wondering what other books you might recommend about Iraq and Afghanistan.
Iraq and Afghanistan, yes. Well, Max, first of all, my former neighbor from Cairo is Max Rodenbeck. He's the correspondent for The Economist. He doesn't get a byline, so you won't see his name very often there. But he did write a terrific book called Cairo, the City Victorious, and that came out several years ago. And especially if you've ever been there, it's a terrific, deeply researched and very well-written book. Iraq, there's been a lot of books written about Iraq. The best book about the sort of bumbling in the green zone and Americans not understanding what they were doing early was written by Rajiv Chandrakson, I think, from the Washington Post. And the title of that, I can't remember right now. It was the one that was made into the movie Green Zone just recently, loosely adapted, I should say. The obvious book from Afghanistan, I think, is the Three Cups of Tea by Greg Mortensen, the man who was educating or building schools so others could educate Afghan girls, and he now has another one out, I believe. I am a big fan of the book that Christopher de Belleg wrote about Iran in The Rose Garden of the Martyrs, which was his memoir of that time, and he's a very good writer. And I'll put in a plug for a friend in Turkey, actually, Hugh Pope, who's an analyst with the International Crisis Group, who used to be a Wall Street Journal correspondent, 30 years or so roaming around the Middle East. He just wrote a terrific memoir of all, some of it's in Afghanistan, including a very scary conversation with the Taliban. Anyway, it's called Dining with Al-Qaeda. It just came out recently. It's really very good.
Thank you very much for coming, and welcome back. As you travel around that area of the world, what are the issues or what are the stories that you can see are will be coming down the line that perhaps this country and its foreign policy is not yet paying attention?
Well, we talked about Yemen a bit. That just could be a disaster waiting to happen. I think... Well, actually, I can combine this in the last question. Another book that I found really interesting, it's a bit controversial, but it has to do with America's approach in the Middle East, who their key allies are, and whether they might shift that a little bit. It's by Stephen Kinzer, the guy who wrote All the Shah's Men about the 53 coup in Iran. But his new one is called Reset, and his proposition, a bold proposition, is that the Americans might do well to readjust their foreign policy and pay a little bit more attention to places like Turkey and Iran, where they have, in Iran in particular, where they have a long history of wanting democracy and not getting it very often, but they're very predisposed in that direction, just culturally, and dialing down the relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel. The latter part will be, of course, quite controversial here in some circles, but I think it's a pretty provocative thesis, and I found the book very well researched, and I enjoyed it. So I think, yeah, picking your allies, and because Turkey, I think, is growing, very much so, and you've got to pay more attention to it, and I think we will eventually.
How are the Chinese using their influence in the Middle East, and... How do you think that's going to change over time?
Well, I think it's going. I think. Well, I would say it will increase over time. I think they've pretty much set their path. They want resources, they want energy, and they want farmland. They want food, and so they're buying farmland in Africa. They are dealing with all kinds of dictators and failed states on energy, donating lots of money in return for getting in on the ground floor and guaranteeing an energy supply. And the same thing with minerals and mines. And the biggest example at the moment in the Middle East is their dealings with Iran. And they are reluctant. They are very good at going along just enough with the American and the Western, the British desire for sanctions, and yet keeping their hand in on the other side with the Iranians. And they will continue to do that. And as they get more and more powerful an economic player, I mean, I just think that's only going to accelerate.
Peter, I'm wondering how a decade living amid the sectarian, political, religious, and military strife in the Middle East may have affected your view of politics back at home, and what this lens could refract on how you view American politics after being abroad for a decade.
Well, I have to say I'm a bit. A bit evangelical, enjoying the foreign perspective on that, partly because of the 6 years I did in Washington before that. I mean, I enjoyed my time in Washington up to a point, but then at some point it just becomes such a company town and so insular, and the heat and that gets generated as opposed to light is pretty spectacular. So I think, and obviously there's a much more jaundiced view of the American, you know, democratic experiment from overseas in various places, and especially in the Middle East, where they see democracy and all they know is this is the country that comes and invades us, or, you know, or supports the dictator that we hate. And so it's a very difficult issue. And then at the same time, they all want to come to America because they know, they consider it the land of opportunity. So there's this very interesting disconnect of derision of American politics and a love of
the freedoms that they have here.
Okay, there it is. The $60 billion arms deal that the United States has just made with Saudi Arabia, which is a totalitarian regime and which needs the arms in order to defend its position with its people, and the money that it spends to buy the arms to suppress the people is money that is not being used to help the people, which is making them angrier at the government. And it seems to me that it's kind of a vicious cycle. I was just wondering if you had any input on that.
That's all true. I have to say, they have the money to spend on all the arms in the world and still help their people. They just don't do it. I mean, they have their treasury is pretty staggering. But there is a huge gap between the royal family and the average Saudi, and it does fuel a lot of resentment. And then you combine that with the deal that they made with the Wahhabists, the very conservative Sunni Muslim group that keeps them in power in exchange for being able to inculcate Saudis with their views, their Wahhabist views, and export it all over the region. I mean, there's all of these countries, Morocco and Jordan and other places, who had much milder versions of Sunni Islam, almost Sufi-like, very sort of peaceful, moderate versions, that have now been changed because of the Saudi money and the Saudi schools that come in, and it really is a remarkable spread of that. As far as the arms deals, nominally a lot of this is defend against some kind of Iranian attack someday. This, you remember, maybe years ago, the King of Jordan started talking about an arc of Shia, a crescent of Shia influence, you know, after Saddam was toppled, that made Iran much more powerful. And then you've got Bahrain, which is 70% Shia, but ruled by a Sunni minority. And then you've got the eastern Saudi Arabia Shia, which is where all the oil is, by the way. And they've always been very nervous about that. Frankly, there's no evidence that these people are rising up or that they're getting, you know, much support from Iran at this point. But the fear of that is driving a lot of these arms sales and will continue. And then the other thing that's pretty obvious, I guess, is that money is driving this issue. I mean, the arms manufacturers here in the U.S. and in Europe and China and elsewhere are all very eager to sell these people weapons. I just interviewed a general in Iraq about 2 weeks ago, and the very first thing he wanted to talk about when we sat down was the 30 M1 Abrams tanks that had just been delivered to the Iraqi army. So their arms deals sort of are always with us, I'm afraid. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Peter Kenyon, NPR foreign correspondent in Istanbul, Turkey, and former reporter for the Alaska Public Radio Network out of KFSK in Petersburg. Peter was recorded at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium in Anchorage, where he kicked off the very first event in the APRN Speaker Series on October 24th, 2010. Recordings from the APRN Speaker Series continue next week on Addressing Alaskans with Leanne Hansen, former host of Weekend Edition Sunday on NPR. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.